Thanks for coming out. My name's Andrew DelBanco. I'm sort of the Charlie Rose figure here this afternoon. I'm going to be very brief about introducing Ian, in part because if I tried to do it exhaustively, we'd be here all afternoon. Ian Baruma is a writer and a teacher of international reputation. He's the Henry Luce Professor at Bard College, about 100 miles north of here, to which he has to repair later this evening, and the author of many books about many parts of the world. Most recently, a book, not most recently, but penultimately, 2 books ago, a book called Murder in Amsterdam, which was a very thoughtful reflection on some horrific events that took place in that city some years ago that might come up as part of the conversation. And the reason we're here today is his new book called Taming the Gods, Religion and Democracy on 3 Continents, published by Princeton University Press. Ian, as you know, is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, and many other reputable magazines. So I think of my role really as letting Ian tell us about what he's written and why he wrote it, but I guess I wanted to not provoke, but open things up with one observation. You write about the relation between religion and politics on 3 continents. And you begin with Tocqueville's reflections on the place of religion in American life. And we're all aware, as Americans or visitors to America or whoever we are, that religion does continue to play a very important role in our public discourse, and we're debating all the time about the line between church and state and so on. It all put me in mind of an experience I had a few years ago when someone was talking about religion in America, and a scholar from Europe, this was before the series of events that you've been concerned with, stood up and said, you know, I find this preoccupation with religion very peculiar. He was actually from Scotland. And he said, where I come from, all the churches have become bingo halls. Which he delivered that line with great, wonderful enunciation. In other words, that religion is part of the past in Europe, and why are you still thrashing out these issues in America? So I thought I would invite you to reflect a little bit on that contrast and see if that gets us into the conversation.
Yeah, I think what's changed, if you look at the last century in European attitudes, let's take just the anti-American attitudes in Europe, it's changed considerably, because before the war, most people who were anti-American were people on the right, who thought America was shallow and materialistic and hedonistic and a place without culture, basically. Whereas now, if you talk to people who have a problem with America, religion comes up as one of the objections, religion and the death penalty often. And by religion, people mean what they see on TV when they're in their hotel rooms and they switch it on in the morning in that jet-lagged state, and they see televangelists and so on, but also, of course, the mobilization in the last decade or so of the religious right. What they forget, like your friend the Scot, is how recent it was that most countries in Europe were still profoundly religious. That goes for the Catholic South, but it also goes for the country that I grew up in, the Netherlands, which likes to cultivate the image of being more secular and more liberal and more free-spirited than anywhere else on earth. When I grew up, and you were silly enough to, well, maybe not silly enough, but if you switched on the radio on a Sunday, all you'd hear all Sunday was sermons of one kind or another. You had a Catholic radio station and a Dutch Reformed radio station and a different kind of Protestant radio station and so on. You even had a humanist radio station, and they preach all day long about humanism. And so it was soaked in religion, and it only rarely got seriously dented in the 1960s everywhere. I mean, that goes for France and Italy and Holland as well. That's when people started turning away from the church. And what's interesting, I think, about Tocqueville's observations about America, he was here in the
30s,
was that he said, in America, in Europe, religion and political freedom always seem to be going in opposite directions. In other words, what Europeans who object to religion object to is not so much religion itself, it's objecting to the authority of the churches, the sort of established religion. Whereas in the United States, people talk about religion as though it's the same thing as freedom. And I think what had happened, and the difference in the historical difference between the two continents, is that people rebelled against the big, organized, traditional Christian churches in America long before they rebelled in Europe. And so the televangelists are really the sort of the heirs, in a way, of all the tent shows, and that's not the right phrase, but the sort of the popular evangelical religious movements that you already had here in the late 18th century when people rebelled against the authority of the established churches. And they didn't do this in Europe to the same extent, even though that rebellion started in places like England. But the real rebellion really only came in the 1960s, and there is no, as yet, and that's an interesting thing to speculate on, but there's as yet no strong evangelical movement in Europe. So if there were to be a religious revival, it's difficult to see people going back to Catholicism or Calvinism or anything like that. So at the moment, people who still have a theological bent of mind, ironically, are the ones who are in the forefront of those who warn us against the Islamization of Europe or Europe turning into Eurabia with the same sort of zeal often as the people they denounce. You even hear one or two voices like that in the United States. You might even, if you stick around, hear something of that nature later.
Right. Well, now this isn't, you know, I think lurking in your book is a version, it's not the primary theme, but there's a theme of what's sometimes called American exceptionalism, which we associate with Tocqueville, right? Tocqueville's basic point being that the history of the United States is totally different from that of any society in Western Europe because we didn't have to get ourselves out of the medieval phase one way or the other. That in Europe you have this vestige or residue of conflict between the forces of secularism, capitalism, whatever, however you want to group them, and the power of the church, which was intertwined with the state in an intimate way. Whereas in the United States, there never was that connection between church and state. We began with the political foundation of the United States is a scripted separation between church and state. So that's one, if you want to talk a little bit about that, that would be good. But the other thing that your comments put me in mind of is that Tocqueville, and I think even some of his predecessors, one of the reasons they seem to think that religious conflict and sectarian competition didn't really amount to much in the United States was because of the sheer size. That it's somewhere in Tocqueville, I think there's this metaphor of, you know, religious fervor can burn very hotly, but it tends to evaporate into thin air because there's nothing around that's combustible. And if you look at American history, it's true that much of radical religion in the United States tend to be separatist. We want to do our thing. We want to worship in our way. We'll go somewhere else. As long as you agree to leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. And that seems not to be possible in Europe for a number of reasons, one of which may just be the physical configuration of the continent. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, except for a few things. I was put in my place very politely by a professor from Chicago not so very long ago, and I said more or less what you're saying. And then he said, well, but don't forget, religious freedom really only became reality in the United States in the middle of the 20th century because there was a very strong anti-Catholic bias here. And I mean, even when the first Kennedy ran for president, I mean, it was still an issue. And so it's not quite true to say that that this tolerance was always there to the extent that, I mean, it's not quite so rosy a picture. The other thing I would say is that in many ways, of course, in European countries, the different faiths did come to some kind of arrangement. And a figure who, in Dutch politics, who, oddly enough, is now probably more famous amongst American evangelicals than he is in Holland itself, Abraham Kuyper, there is even an Abraham Kuyper Prize of Theology at Princeton, was one of these people. And like a lot of evangelicals, he was a great admirer of the American Revolution. This was a late 19th century politician, and in Holland, a Calvinist. And he believed, and talked a little bit like the Tea Party people, some of the Tea Party people do now. He said, the Protestants are the only real people, the real Dutch people, the volk, as it were. The liberals, the socialists, the Catholics, well, the Catholics are not really part of our people. Anyway, the liberals, you know, they may be cleverer than you and I, they may have read more books, but they're not the real people. He did is he started a Calvinist party, and he started the system, the so-called pillars, where society would be organized from top down in these pillars, led in many cases by a particular religious denomination. And everything in your life, from birth to the schools you went to the kind of sports clubs you joined, to the pension funds you subscribed to the stores you do your shopping at, to the newspapers you read, were all part of your particular pillar. So if you were a Catholic pillar, you voted for the Catholic Party, you read Catholic papers, etc. And the different Protestant denominations, the same thing. And the reason why Cowper was such a promoter of this notion, and a promoter of the separation of church and state, was precisely the same as something you see in American history, which was an unlike French history, which was to separate church and state to protect the church against the secular state, rather than in the French Revolution, where people wanted this separation to protect the secular republic from the power of the Catholic Church. So one can exaggerate the differences between the two concepts.
It's a good point, and people are sometimes surprised to be reminded that a very powerful force on behalf of religious liberty in this country came from what we would think of today as the evangelical right. 18th century Baptists, for instance, who insisted on their right to do their thing and not be told not what to do. But to linger with this America-Europe contrast a little longer. Your friend from Chicago has a fair point.
A Catholic, by the way.
Right. But on the other hand, you know, there's this well-known book, I don't know if anybody reads it anymore, by Will Herberg from the 1950s called Protestant Catholic Jew. And his argument was that in America, religious factions tend to after a few generations, the distinctions between them tend to get blurred, if not erased. They tend to get deracinated, and there's a kind of an all-purpose ecumenical religion that we call Judeo-Christianity, which is a favored term in this country, has been for some time. And people are allowed to do their own thing as long as they subscribe to this general civil religion, as it is sometimes called. I mean, in the case of John Kennedy, of course, had to overcome frank and widespread bias against Catholics. What he really had to do was to persuade the voting public that he wasn't going to take orders from the Vatican. And once he succeeded in doing that, the problem was, I mean, it was never totally over, but it was over enough for him to win the election.
Yes.
Whereas I don't think that, I don't know, we want to call it a process of homogenization or a process in which the sectarian lines become less sharp. That doesn't seem to have been the case in some of countries in Europe. It's more of an agreement to live a peaceful coexistence.
Yeah. No, I think that's correct. But Tocqueville said two other things, which I think were very prescient, because you still see it in this country today. One thing that he said apropos of the Catholics is that the Catholics behave like the Protestants in the U.S. He wasn't so sure if they would behave like the Protestants if they were in the majority. So he said they want separation of church and state and liberty and so on just as much as the Protestants do, but they would, being a vulnerable minority. But the other thing that he saw, which was the religion as a business in the United States, I mean, that it's a capitalist enterprise. Whereas the churches in Europe had privileges, but they weren't really businesses. I mean, they made a lot of money, but you, off land, and they were traditional privileges. Whereas I remember driving through Texas a few years ago, and you would see these billboards on the side of the freeways, and some of them were for banks, to open up particular investment accounts, and others were for new religions, and they were basically the same. It would even use the same phrases, invest in your future, invest in God, or whatever it was. And they would all, in their different ways, promise the good life. But it, in both cases, was openly, unashamedly a business. And there is something, and this you could, from a sort of snobbish European point of view, you could sneer at this as something vulgar, but there is a positive, very positive side to this, which is that religion, like anything else, if it becomes something in the marketplace, you have to, go out and sell. You know, people can take it or leave it, and that is surely better with all the vulgarity and exploitation that goes with any form of capitalist enterprise than a belief that's imposed on people, right, which was of course much more the case until recently in European history.
Right. Well, one of the things, one of the striking features of both of the books I've mentioned is that you take religion seriously. That is, you don't write about it as if it were only and always a problem, which I think is a pitfall that some sophisticated intellectuals tend to fall into. It's not going to go away. It speaks to a need that all human beings in all the societies that you write about have. So it takes different forms, and the relationship among the different religions and between religion and those who feel they're outside religion has to be continually renegotiated as times change. Now, what you're writing about in this most recent book and in the Murder in Amsterdam book, obviously, is the question that's much on the mind of all of us, I'm sure, and that is the reintroduction into Europe in recent years as part of the post-colonial phenomenon of a significant population of fervent believers who, from some perspectives that have been very outspoken in Europe, are alien elements. And you write about this very, very subtly and from a number of different perspectives, and maybe I should invite you to talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, I think it's a phenomenon that is widely misunderstood, because people tend to describe this as a kind of clash of civilizations, that this is an alien element imported into Europe of alien values, and that clash with Western values. And then you have the sort of dogmatic multiculturalists who are criticized for saying, well, but we should respect everybody's values, and then you have those who say, well, no, there are certain values you can't respect. And in fact, I think both sides have it slightly wrong, because it's not a question of one tradition rubbing up against another, because the problem that we should take seriously, not only in Europe but here too, is violent extremism in the name of religion, in this case of Islam. That's not to say that all Islam or all Islamic tradition is violent or extreme, but there is this violent revolutionary element that has come up from the Middle East for all kinds of reasons. Now, the people who are attracted to that kind of extremism are not the immigrants, the guest workers who come from villages in Anatolia or the Rif Mountains in Morocco, introducing alien traditions. The original guest workers who came in the 60s and 70s, men who did backbreaking work, sent a lot of their money back home, led very sad lives usually, they're not revolutionaries. They were too poor and too hardworking and too exhausted to be revolutionaries, even if they'd wanted to be. In any case, they were not religious zealots either. They usually were Muslims in the tradition of their villages. They would go to the mosques, but that's all. The problem, the people who are attracted to extremism are people who are born in Europe, on the whole, either converts or the children or grandchildren of these original guest workers. Now, why are they attracted to this? And why them and not, say, Hindus? Both questions are important. I think all young people are vulnerable to violent causes or causes that seem to give you a sense of the meaning of life and something to sacrifice for and so on. We see that at universities. And these courses can be religious, they can be political. When you don't know your place in the world and you're struggling and so on, you're vulnerable to that kind of thing. There's nothing unusual about that. Children of immigrants, especially if they're despised immigrants and they have reason to feel humiliated, ashamed of their parents who don't speak the language, get insulted when they go shopping and so on, are probably especially vulnerable. Now, Hindus don't have a ready-made political cause to live or die for, even though there is a Hindu nationalist party in India, but it's not a worldwide cause. These young people do have a ready-made cause in political, violent Islam, revolutionary Islam. And some of them take it up, but most of them, including the one I wrote about in Murder in Amsterdam, the murderer of Theo van Gogh, was not at all religious when he was young. I mean, he wasn't interested. He was interested in soccer and girls and drinking beer and so on. And it's when one too many doors get slammed in your face, for whatever reason, you feel rejected by the society you grew up in, you're alienated from the culture of your parents, and suddenly this religious cause seems to have all the answers. You feel empowered, you have a family, you have whatever it is. But it's not a tradition. It's a modern phenomenon. It's a revolutionary movement in political guise, in religious guise, and it's something we have to deal with. But I think we get it very wrong if we say, well, this is inevitable, and it's the inevitable clash of one tradition rubbing up against another. Not only, I think, is it analytically wrong, I think that conclusion is also dangerous in practice, because these immigrants are there to stay. And unless you are in favor of putting them all in cattle cars and deporting them, and there are such voices, you have to deal with it. And you can't really say, well, the only way to deal with them is if they're all prepared to give up their faith, which some people also say, but that's not the answer. So you have to deal with it in some way. And the only way to isolate the violent revolutionary element is to not to alienate those who are not violent, even if they have views and values we may not always share.
Yeah, you end the Murder in Amsterdam book with a personal reflection of, I think you're on a bus or a underground train, I can't remember which, and there's the big soccer match between Holland and Germany is about to take place, and you have all these fanatic soccer fans dressed in orange and singing patriotic songs and so on. And it's very nicely written. You try to hide behind your newspaper, and you're not assaulted, but confronted by someone who wants to know if you're a true Dutch patriot because you're not singing along. And the impression one gets at the end of that book is that you're writing about this sort of latent xenophobia and nativistic quasi-fascistic impulse, which has been awakened by this opportunity to conflate these, what you describe as relatively few religious fanatics, with the whole so-called alien population.
Yes. Well, soccer is the last legitimate form of nationalist expression in post-war Europe, because waving flags, let alone hand on the heart and that kind of thing, admiration of the military and all that, that was really taboo after World War II, except in some respects in Britain, because it hadn't been occupied and they felt they won the war, and France a little bit. But in most other European countries, that kind of nationalist sentiment was taboo. The only place where you could vent it was in the soccer stadium. That's where you could wave flags and sing patriotic songs. And the Dutch football fans still sing songs about beating the Spanish Armada in the 17th century. There it was legitimate. It was the last outlet, as it were. And this has changed also a little bit. But until not so long ago, for the Dutch, for the Poles, for the British, English, beating Germany, of course, had particular significance. It was World War II all over again. So when Holland finally beat Germany in the European Championships in 1988, It led to a kind of folk festival in the streets in all Dutch cities that was bigger than Liberation Day 1945, which is a kind of pathology if you think about it, but it shows that with all the post-war taboos, that national identity, certainly in Holland, is very much defined now by World War II, and especially vis-à-vis Germany. It's changed now. Berlin has become the cool place to go. We don't mind so much if Germany wins a soccer match anymore, and so on. So, but it's changed, certainly changed in my lifetime. Now, the reason I wrote this, with sitting in this bus with these soccer fans in their orange is the color of the royal family, with sort of hats in the shape of cheeses and cows and so on, was also to describe how quickly carnival can turn into violence, which is, of course, a common universal human phenomenon. People who are laughing and dancing and so on, it's a knife edge. It can quickly turn into something much darker. And when I was sitting in this bus with these people stamping and so on and singing patriotic songs and about the Germans and the Spanish and other traditional enemies, and I was, as one does usually in these circumstances, like meeting tourists of your own nationality. They're always much more annoying than tourists from anywhere else. It's vaguely embarrassing. So I was trying to hide. And then one of these men came up to me, still in a kind of festive spirit, and say, "So why aren't you singing along?" And with a slight edge in the voice, "Aren't you Dutch?" "Yes, I am." So, "Well, why aren't you with us?" And I could feel that it could very quickly descend into aggression. I wouldn't go so far as to say there is latent fascism, but I think that the fear-mongering that's going on at the moment, which is not directly because of Muslims or immigration, it's to do with the same things that go on everywhere, the economic crisis, globalization, a sense of that national identity is shifting and being eroded by international institutions, by an economy that's no longer controlled by any one nation state and so on. All these anxieties are there, and they're being exploited, and it's led to a kind of a populism, like here, that is directed against the elite, except unlike here, the elite is blamed for allowing uncontrolled immigration, especially of Muslims, who have changed life, particularly in working-class neighborhoods. And people who'd complain about it would often be accused of being racists, and so there's deep resentment against the elites because of this. And so those people are receptive to voices that talk about Arabia and Islamization and having to stand up against Islamofascism and so on and so forth. And the orange element, although still festive, you could see how it could turn into an ugly form of nativism. But I was fairly careful, I think, in that book to say that that was not yet the case and that there is no real violence of that kind yet. There are no pogroms, and there is no moral equivalency between a football supporter with a cow on his head and the killer of Theo van Gogh. Of course, some people have chosen to read it in that way, in that I'm a postmodernist, a moral relativist, appeaser of Islam, and so on and so forth, but that was not the intention.
No, but you do get a feeling, at least I get the feeling reading these books, that you're describing a culture which is conceivably on the verge of some serious trouble, and that part of the purpose of your writing is to make some suggestions about how that trouble might be averted. So if I understand you correctly, one of the things you want to do is you want to de-theologize this situation. Mm-hmm. You want to say, look, this guy who killed Theo van Gogh is a bad guy, and he's properly in jail for the rest of his life. And you actually, I think, your critics have been unfair to you in this regard. You are very clear about the uncompromising actions that need to be taken against radicalism when it shades into violence. But you want to say that we shouldn't confuse what you consider to be a very small minority who are prepared to make violent actions with the larger number of, I guess you call them European Muslims now, who may believe things that are anathema both to the right and to the left. And one of the points you make is that they tend to be an occasion for the right and the left to come together on certain issues. But you don't want to confuse these people with the small number of bad actors. And that the long-term solution to this problem is to create or make possible a feeling of belongingness to these people. Now, I wonder if you could talk a little about that, and I wouldn't mind, if you were willing, if you might say, again, some comparative things about how you think we've managed that in America versus how it's being managed in Europe.
That's the key question, because you can talk about belongingness, but it's not always clear what people are supposed to belong to.
Right.
First of all, you can't talk even about the Muslims or even the European Muslims, because it's a very, very diverse group, and they haven't succeeded in even rarely organizing a Muslim party, because there's too little common ground. They're culturally, even in terms of faith, very diverse. But what is it? If you say people have to integrate, apart from the desirability of learning the language of the country they grow up in, which clearly is desirable because otherwise you're at a great economic disadvantage. What is it that people are supposed to integrate into? In the United States, it's not such a difficult question, because here to be an American citizen is very much a political concept. It means you are loyal to the Constitution, to the political system, to the flag, you play by the rules and so on, and then whatever you want to wear on your head is your business. Europe, because countries don't have such a clearly defined political concept of their national identities, it's trickier, because national identity is more shaped by a sense of common myths, history, ethnicity, and so on and so forth. And many Europeans, of course, also forget how recent national identity in Europe is. I mean, not so long ago, most people living in France didn't speak French. They spoke all kinds of variations of it, but mutually incomprehensible. It had to be enforced. But what is it now, apart from football, again, which really is important? It's the one thing that everybody can rally around. Television personalities. You have these national television personalities, the sort of that everybody watches, which is a common factor. Apart from that, it's very difficult. And the main difficulty is, I think, that certainly in countries like the Netherlands, France is a little bit different, because they have this idea of the Republican identity with all its problems, but at least it's something analogous to the American concept. A place like Holland, which is more typical, it's a bit like being a member of a club with unspoken rules, codes, and so on, that everybody kind of knows, but are unspoken. So an outsider doesn't necessarily get beaten up, but it's very difficult for an outsider to be accepted as a fellow member of the club, because they wear the wrong kind of shoes. Or it's almost like class in that sense, in the way that in Britain you can kind of sniff somebody's class by just seeing, you know, the kind of jacket he wears. And it takes a long time for those things to be sorted out. It's why people don't have the same idea of the hyphenated identity in Europe as they have here. I mean, here you can be in Iraqi American, if you like. It's difficult to be an Iraqi Frenchman or an Iraqi Dutchman. And I remember, for example, when I lived in Berlin for a year, watching literary television program, which, you know, run and done by impeccably liberal people. And there was a poet of Turkish origin, born in Berlin, who, as far as I know, only writes in German, but he was constantly referred to as a Turkish Schriftsteller, a Turkish writer. Now, that wouldn't happen here. And those are deep-seated feelings that people have, and I don't think it spells necessarily disaster. It just means that it's going to take much longer, I think, for people to have this sense that whatever the color of your skin or whatever the background of your family, you're still an entirely a fellow citizen.
Yeah. Well, this, I think, goes to the question of asking you for some predictions and prophecies, speaking about the future. No, but what I mean by that is that I found myself thinking as I was reading you, you know, I spend some time thinking about the American past, and it's my impression that every generation identifies some relatively newly arrived group of outsiders who are regarded as unassimilable. At one time it was the Jews who were regarded as members of a different race, and then it was even the Germans in cities like Chicago and Milwaukee were regarded as, you know, un-American to the core. We've already spoken a little bit about the problem of Catholicism as it was seen from the corridors of power in mainstream America. And you hear this said today about Hispanic Americans and about Asian Americans, that they somehow have some extra-national loyalty that's going to persist over the generations. And the group that is most conspicuously in that category now in the minds of a lot of people are recent arrivals from the Middle East or from, in some cases, from South Asia, who may have either a fervent or a familial loyalty to Islam. These people somehow can't be integrated into the larger society. As you can probably tell from the way I'm putting the question, I'm skeptical of that view, and I think that over the generations we've found in this country, and I know I sound a bit too much like a booster, we've found a pretty reasonable way of letting people be themselves and also finding a place in the American body politic. So my question is that a fair view of how it works here? And by comparison, what do you expect in the years and decades ahead as this problem continues to unfold in Europe?
Well, I don't know, with all respect, because you're an American, I'm not, and you know more about these things, but my take on America at the moment is not that most people think people from the Middle East are such a huge problem, partly because, unlike in Europe, many immigrants in the Middle East here are either not Muslims at all, but Christians, or, which is the case of, I think, most of them, they're quite highly educated. So it's actually already a middle class. And they're not as highly concentrated as in Europe either, except in places like Dearborn, Michigan, which is slightly unusual. In Europe now, even provincial towns, you'll now suddenly see, and I say suddenly, it has happened in the last 20 years or so, suddenly see a very large number of people in headscarves who simply weren't there in the past. And also the majority of non-Western immigrants in European countries are Muslims. Mm-hmm. So it's seen as a problem for that reason alone, whereas it seems less of a problem in the U.S. But as we know from recent events in Arizona and so on, clearly it is still a problem in the U.S. But it's class, and that's true everywhere, as much as ethnicity. And I think that's an element that people have missed in the whole analysis of these problems, both in Europe and in the U.S., in that when large crowds of people who pay money to hear Sarah Palin talk about taking back America, it's not necessarily taking it back from the Muslims. It's taking it back from you, and if I were an American, from me. I mean, it's those East Coast liberals, those socialists, those pinkos, those that's a class resentment as much as it is a form of racism. And the same is true in Europe to some extent. One thing that I wrote about the murder in Amsterdam, which people didn't really pick up on, or they picked, was when I wrote about Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who is a very interesting and pivotal figure in all this. Born in Somalia, grew up as a young woman. For those of you who haven't read her autobiography, grew up, rebelled as a teenager, became a fervent Muslim, Orthodox Muslim. Went to Holland to escape from an enforced marriage, renounced her faith, became an atheist, and so on, and became very active in fighting for the rights of women who were oppressed in the name of Islam, in her view. And she impressed and convinced a lot of white liberals, as it were, but she didn't have a huge impact on the kind of women whose rights she was supposedly fighting for. And one of the reasons was class, that she was very well educated, and she was telling these not very well educated Muslim women, who were often battered wives, who really were victims of the kind, that they should renounce this stupid faith. And that created, of course, resentment. I think that if we think of you know, why Europe, the difference between the United States and Europe, there's another interesting element in that. In that it's not for nothing that she moved to the U.S. because I think her desire to move to the U.S. is also somewhat analogous to Margaret Thatcher's Americophilia, which is that people who are very ambitious, who pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, who make it, as it were, and who think making it is the most important thing in life, tend to despise people of their own class who didn't do the same thing, and who are still either still religious or didn't make that kind of money and so on. And they tend to like America in some ways for all the wrong reasons and despise Europe.
Right. Well, it's surely true that one of the positive forces to foster, I don't want to use words like assimilation or integration, but functional coexistence, let's say, has been economic expansion in American history and economic opportunity in American history, which can be overstated. And now that we're living in what seems to be the post-union age and at a moment when the economy has been contracting rather than expanding, there's reason to worry whether that will continue. But so I guess my question, and then maybe after this we'll throw it open to questions from the audience, what's the prospect for fostering this belongingness that you prescribe? I mean, you've painted a somewhat discouraging picture in your last few remarks. I mean, how are these people going to be made to feel that they have a stake in these societies in which they find themselves living?
Well, I'm not so pessimistic because, you know, people like intellectuals like me make a living out of talking about all these things in dark terms, but on the ground, actually, a lot of people are integrating. And if you look at an average hospital now in a country in Europe with large numbers of Muslim immigrants, you'll find that a lot of the doctors, nurses, and so on are Muslims. And many of the law students at the universities now are not only Muslims, they're Muslim women. And not just Muslim women, but often women with headscarves. And one of the reasons that they are ambitious and they study hard and they study law is to get away from the authority of the men in their families. Uh-huh. And so actually a lot is moving, even though, you know, people still make a decent living writing books professing doom. So I'm not so pessimistic about this. But I don't think it's going to be easy. I think there will be more acts of violence and answered perhaps sometimes by unwise policies. But that's not only the case in Europe. I mean, if we think of this city where there was a bomb last night, and one of the speculations was that it had something to do with the people who threatened the South Park, the producers of South Park. There you have a serious issue because I think that we can live with many different peoples who don't share the same values necessarily when it comes to, I don't know, gay rights or contentious issues like that. What you can't live with is people who will threaten to use violence or use violence to impose their views or to stop others from expressing them. So in my view, I think the producers of South Park were foolish to give in to people who intimidated them by threatening violence if they did anything satirical about the Prophet Muhammad. But the other danger is that if people do commit acts of violence, is to overreact, and which can endanger our democratic institutions and our freedoms just as much. And I think this is the balance that constantly has to be preserved, both in Europe and the United States. And that's the really hard part, I think.
On that cautiously optimistic note, let me invite any questions from the audience. And I would like to point out we have a microphone over here, so if you could use that, that would be helpful.
Hi there. I'm very glad to hear you use the expression people earning a living. And I'd like to ask you to talk about the money, the funding that goes into these industries, which history shows have used religious sectarianism inherent in Western religion for 500 years. People like Catherine de' Medici, Elizabeth I, or in Ludovic of Orange and Nassau were players spending money on publishing Calvinism. Today we have youth groups, universities. We can trace funding to madrasas from royal families, yeshivas, all sorts of institutions that reach young people precisely to achieve the goals. And they also make much of random events of violence. They make good money off of that. So could you comment on that, please, and how you think it's different here versus Europe?
Well, I'm not sure it is different here versus Europe. I think one has to be careful to distinguish different groups and different goals. The Al-Qaeda-type violence does not necessarily rely on huge amounts of money. I think a lot of the violent acts are committed by people who are very, very loosely affiliated, sometimes simply inspired by similar groups elsewhere. And the speed of information, of course, now has made a huge difference, so that something very quickly spreads globally. So you get a lot of copycat violence. But that's not based on huge cash flows. Where I think there is indeed a problem, if you simply want to talk about the Islamic side of things, is, but I'm not sure that the yeshivas and so on are an enormous social issue anywhere. Yes, and you have lobbies, and yeah, that's true. But I think where there is a serious problem is that there is substantial money being spent by the Saudis, for example, and that is changing things. You see it in Southeast Asia, in countries like Malaysia or Indonesia, where people have a tradition of Islam that is quite different from the Arab world, for example. And it's being steadily Arabized, partly because of Saudi money. And the Saudis are playing a very complicated game, because I think that they are spending a lot of this kind of money in order to keep the violent religious zealots in their own country at bay. So that's about all I can say about it. I really don't know enough about the financing of Christian groups in the United States and so on to say anything very intelligent.
Hi, two questions. One is that I am very sympathetic with your... Is it better now?
Yes.
Thanks. So I'm very sympathetic with your argument to say that it's about extremist, violent group what causes the problem. And also that we need to work for avoiding alienating the majority of the group to which those extremists belong to, even if there are fundamental disagreements. But it seems to me there is a doubt that those disagreements might be that fundamental that might be connected to the violent ideas. And so honor killing would be an example which is not about terrorism. It's just the most extreme expression of such a fundamental value system. So how would you accommodate that? And the other question, very quickly, that I am from Central Europe, Budapest, I wonder what you think that what might be some underlying common patterns in different European countries where extreme right-wing parties became stronger recently, both in the West, where the Muslim immigrant and immigrant problem quote-unquote, seems to be the driving force, and Central East European post-communist countries, where the target of prejudices, the targets of prejudices are still the traditional targets, the Jewish and Gypsy communities, mm-hmm. besides homophobia.
Right. Now I've forgotten the first question. Sorry, what was the first? Just remind me quickly.
The first question is.
Oh yes, the fundamental values like honor killings and so on. I don't think that that's a terribly complicated problem, because I think everybody should abide by the law, and killing somebody for whatever reason is breaking the law and should be punished as such. And I don't think a court of law should accept as a mitigating factor, yes, but in our value system, having a boyfriend before marriage is unacceptable, and so you have to understand why we did it. I don't think that sort of understanding is really necessary. I think there you can take a fairly hard line. That such killings are always a direct result or reflection of different values. Yes, they are different values, but sometimes they can be exacerbated precisely because of immigration, because people are in a new country, they feel powerless, the men in particular, and so are perhaps more likely to react violently in certain circumstances than they would if they'd stayed in the country where they were born, which is not a mitigating factor. But it does suggest that in time, with new generations growing up in the West, those problems will grow less. My guess is that they would. The second question, whether there are similarities, you say, between the right with the extreme right wing? Yes, because they both, in both cases, exploit common fears, general anxieties, and project it on vulnerable minorities, and then it's almost incidental who the minorities are. They can be traditional ones, the Gypsies, the Jews, and so on, and they can be new ones. It doesn't make a huge amount of difference. The reason, I mean, the exploitation is the same, and the motives of the exploitation tend also to be the same, namely thirst for power.
I wanted you to touch a little bit on the earlier killing of Pim Fortuyn and where that fit into it. And then something I think you just alluded to tangentially, an earlier immigrant group to Holland, the Indonesians, who had a legitimate gripe. They were colonized. I don't recall a religion issue arising in all the years that they've lived there. I don't recall seeing any different...
Okay. Did everybody hear the question? Okay, the first question was about the killing of Pim Fortuyn, the sort of father of Dutch populism, if you like. The second question was about the Indonesian immigrants who should have had a real post-colonial gripe, but there was never a religious issue. Well, I'll take the second question first. There weren't that many Indonesian immigrants, very few, in fact. And the ones who did were from a very highly educated upper class and were not particularly religious. The ones who came were the Eurasians, the so-called Indos in Holland. And they were always people who were desperately keen to be Dutch, and often to the extent of being very right-wing and nationalistic. Now, Geert Wilders, the successor of Pim Fortuyn, who is now the great populist rabble-rouser talking about Eurasia and Islamization and so on, is from that background. His grandparents were Eurasians. The reason he has that weird platinum blonde dyed hair is partly to hide the fact that he looks quite swarthy. And it comes from a particular tradition, which is that the people who were Eurasians, there were all kinds of... It's a very sinister story, but there were the history of racism in the Dutch East Indies is quite complex, and you had different ranks. And you had on top you had the white Dutch, and then you had the Eurasians who were educated as Dutch in Dutch schools and so on, as sons of Dutch fathers. Then you had the Eurasians who were brought up by their mothers, often not speaking much Dutch, in villages, and so on. And everybody felt superior to somebody, except the very lowest. And so the people who immigrated or came to Holland were Dutch citizens already, and they were Eurasians, and they were not Muslims. In fact, they were quite the opposite. The first question, Pim Fortuyn was a very interesting figure, a socialist originally, who a sociologist, an openly and very flamboyant gay man, became a populist, but not a populist like Jean-Marie Le Pen in France, with this kind of fascist background. He was, although he did stir similar anxieties, but he was a populist who actually argued that the great threat to liberalism, to Dutch liberties, including gay rights, came from immigrants and specifically from Muslims, and therefore we had to, as it were, go back to Holland for the Dutch and so on, because otherwise we'd be less free. That was one of his arguments. The man who killed him was an extreme vegan, and which in itself is rather interesting because it shows that people who have, as my friend and co-author on one of my books, Avishai Margalit, has argued in his latest book, Compromises and Rotten Compromises, he made a distinction between religious politics and economic politics. And by religious politics, he didn't mean politics of a particular faith. He meant politics that are theological, that are founded on a claim to absolute truth, that have a view of a sort of an ideal society and so on, and cannot be compromising. Whereas economic politics are more about interests about which you can argue and you can strike compromises and so on. Now, people who have a religious political mind can come from any direction. They can be violently atheist or aggressively atheist. They can be Muslim. They can be Christian. They can be vegan. And this guy came from a small town. His mother was an English Pentecostalist. His father was a strict Calvinist. And he became this extreme vegan and thought that Pim Fortuyn was not only a frivolous and immoral and sinful person, but had somehow got it into his head that he was a kind of satanic figure and that it would be a great thing for mankind to shoot him. Either that or you have to shout.
Yeah, but it doesn't make any difference.
Oh, well, shout.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about the difference between Europe and the United States when it comes to immigration. And I mean Muslim immigration.
Could you, a little closer to the mic?
Yeah, we have... it is, I think, a difference of numbers. For instance, in Germany we have like 4 million Muslim immigrants on a population of 80 million. We have like 3.5 million on a population of 300,000. What we find, and also liberals find it now, the only immigrant group, the larger group, we have problems with to integrate is the Muslim group. Not all of them. More than half of them are willing and have integrated, are a very successful group, especially, for instance, in immigration centers like Berlin and Hamburg and Munich. But there is a minority that hasn't been integrated and, what is more important, doesn't want to integrate. On our side, there was for 40 years, a refusal to even accept the problem that we are an immigration country. Helmut Kohl denied it even in the year 2000. But this is over. But there is a counter-reaction which says, no, we don't want to integrate. And you have a Turkish minister president who came to the Ruhr debate and said, integration is okay, assimilation is a crime. So we have this problem, and we only have it with the Muslim immigrants, and we cannot evade this problem by just saying every group is equal. It's just not true. So why is this? Why is integration of Muslims? Is it just a sheer question of number? Is it a question also of geography?
from Berlin to Istanbul is two flight hours. In 2 hours you are back and take a bus, and then same day you are in your village. Why is that different?
Well, I think we can leave America aside. I think in Europe this depends. This is a problem that varies from country to country. I think the Turkish immigrants and to some extent the Moroccans have a particular problem, often to do with practical matters, that, as you say, that the governments in Turkey and Morocco are very unhelpful in insisting that they cannot lose their nationality. If they insist on losing their Turkish or Moroccan passports, it has consequences on real estate, on inheritance, on all kinds of things. So a lot of those people don't integrate, not necessarily because they don't want to, but because they're forced by circumstances into an impossible position. That's not true in all countries. As far as I know, this problem does not really exist in France. One of the points made about the riots or demonstrations in France in the banlieue, which, by the way, were not all Muslims at all. It's often described as a sort of Muslim riot, but it wasn't. It was all kinds of mostly third world immigrants. But one of the points made about this is that what the people there were demanding was to be treated as equal French citizens and not demanding separation. So I think it's very different from country to country. One of the more interesting ironies, and correct me if I'm wrong to make too much of a point of this, but I remember I found it very amusing at the time, in 1989. I was living in Berlin in 1991, but after 1989, when so-called German speakers from the Volga region and so on could come to Germany and claim German citizenship, this caused quite a lot of tensions. Partly because a lot of these so-called Germans didn't really speak German. And suddenly the Turkish Germans, as it were described in Germany in public discourse as anständige Ausländer, respectable foreigners, because they were born in Germany, they spoke German, they ate, you know, Wurst and so on, whereas these Volga Germans were like real foreigners. And so people's attitudes can be very curious and very fickle, and I think it changes with according to circumstance. And so it's very dangerous to talk in the way that one is tempted to do in America at a distance about European problems, or because all these things are so varied according to different histories, different patterns of immigration. There are differences between countries with a strong post-colonial history where a lot of the immigrants came from former empires, or countries like Germany where none came from former empires. So one has to constantly, I think, see differences rather than claim generalities.
The last time I heard you speak, I think it was at the Goethe Institute at Columbia, and we talked about the difference between people who come to the United States with a little social safety net, and so they must integrate because they have to get a job, they have to learn the language, etc. Whereas in Holland, they don't necessarily have to get a job. There's a social network, and so 50% of the people don't get a job, therefore are not forced to integrate. With the recession that's happened and the global financial crisis, what is that situation like in Holland?
Right. Now, that's a very good question. There is very high employment amongst, relatively high employment, relative to the rest of the population, amongst immigrants, not necessarily because they don't want to work. The welfare state, although splendid in many respects, it wasn't designed to make integration of large numbers of immigrants easier. It was designed as a safety net for the native population if they, for one reason or another, couldn't get work. Now, what happens in a welfare state is you get a lot of government agencies who are much better equipped to sort of deal with the social consequences of unemployment and so on than to make it easier for people to get jobs. In some ways, Ayan Hirsi Ali, in fact, among others, has written very well about that. That sometimes the government actively discourages immigrants to go out and find jobs because it's easier for them to deal with them as social cases. It also means that there is much higher degree of job protection in the United States. in the United States. So the job market is more rigid, which makes it much harder for outsiders to come in at a very low level. And the recession, of course, has made that that worse. The answer, I think, does mean that there has to be more flexibility. Again, coming back to the example of the riots in the banlieue in France, those riots happened. Immigrants, or children of immigrants usually, they were mostly kids born in Paris, but started burning cars and so on after another demonstration had taken place, I think less than a week earlier, and the two were linked. The other demonstration was staged by French university students after the, Sarkozy, then as interior minister, had suggested that they should change the law to make it easier for companies to fire people who'd just been hired for the first time. And so these students then saw that one of their cherished privileges was in danger. That, you know, no longer would it be true that once you get a job, then you're safe. But the immigrants' kids very rightly and clearly saw that these kids were claiming privileges that were actually standing in the way of them finding a place in the workplace. So, yes, I mean, American society is in many ways much harsher, but it, in this respect, it makes it easier for people to come into the workplace, even if it is as hamburger flippers.
Hi. You talked before about people having to respect the law. So if somebody comes to a nation where murder is against the law, they have to respect the law. But how do you have people not feel alienated when laws are made specifically in regard to their customs, such as now in Belgium, where women, they're trying to get a law, I don't know if it's passed yet, where women who traditionally may wear burqas, not that I necessarily agree with it, but by their tradition, they wear burqas. But now, if they either give or provide social services, they cannot wear burqas. In France, there was an issue of whether women could wear headscarves in the national universities. So it makes sense that those communities would feel like these laws are made particularly to attack them. And how are they not going to feel alienated?
Well, again, we have to be careful when we talk about culture and values and so on. The burqa is possibly part of a culture of some people in Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. It's not part of the culture of Moroccans and Turks and most of the Muslim immigrants in Europe. So the very few people who wear burqas, because there are very few, but the very few who do are either tourists from the Gulf, from Saudi Arabia and so on, very rich people on the whole, or they're converts of one kind or another. Very often European converts, sometimes people from Algeria and so on, but who do this not out of tradition, but because they feel that they want to identify with this kind of very radical Islam. So it's not so much that it's an assault on their values. I do think it's a mistake, however, to have these laws, because on the one hand, if you argue... partly because of freedom of speech and religion and so on, but also for practical reasons. If you want people to integrate, then you want people to come out of their homes as much as possible. If you ban this kind of garb in public, you'll make sure that those people will never get out of their house, which is a bad thing. The other practical thing I would say about it is that it's very easy to not have people cover their faces in situations where they shouldn't. And there are such situations in certain public jobs when people have to take passport photographs. I mean, there are all kinds of situations where you cannot have somebody who covers their faces. But you don't have to have a law banning the burqa. What you can do is to make it perfectly legitimate for people who have to adopt certain dress codes for certain jobs in certain situations, and that's already the case. So it's a very heavy-handed and populist move by people who are doing this, I think, to pander to voters they're afraid of losing to the far right.
I think we'll make this the last question.
I come from Denmark, and to me it seems that the whole debate on Islam and the West is like we are in a mass psychosis, basically, and we have, like, you know, with all mythologies, we have made this myth that Islam is dangerous for us because a few elements have turned radical, but, I mean, we all know terrorism, you know, has existed basically since Troy and
I think you have to try and speak
Russia
into
it. And so on. But, you know, there are problems with other immigrant groups. It's just not visible. I mean, if you go to certain areas in Paris, all signs are in Chinese. You cannot manage there unless you speak Chinese. And it's just that they are much less visible. But as I see it, in a sense, ought to be very simple. If one stops to stop the discussion on religion and talk only about acts, as you talk about, you can't kill someone if we're in a society where that's illegal, and I don't care about the reason. And the same if for functionality of a society, you have to be able to identify a person, you know, by viewing the face. You can't have burqas, but who cares about the headscarves? So it's very simple if we just totally separate the discussion of religion and what people believe in, or if they're vegans or whatever, and actions that makes a society function. And we just have to focus on...
Well, on the level of applying the law, I would agree with that entirely. On the level of analysis, it's a little bit more complex,
yeah,
because, after all, the people who carry out these acts of violence do not separate that from religion. In their discourse, the political violence and the religious extremism is the same. And so to say, well, we should completely forget religion, that would hamper you somewhat in trying to come to terms with the people and their motives for doing this. So I would say when we're thinking about the problem and then thinking of ways to respond to it, we shouldn't completely leave religion out, because then you're not recognizing what is at least part of the problem, especially when it also involves financing from Saudi Arabia and Wahhabism and so on and so forth. There is, after all, there is overlap. And you cannot just ignore that. In terms of the law, I agree. Just as I don't think it should be a mitigating factor that somebody says, well, our family honor dictates that we have to kill the daughter, I don't think, you know, religion should be brought into applying the law to a particular act. There you look at the acts. But analyzing the problem, I think you do have to think about religion. Now, whether that means you have to become an expert in the Quran, that's maybe another... I don't think that leads you very far, but I do think you have to take religion into account.
Yeah, but may just add some. The problem with the debate, for example, in Denmark is that so many people talk about Islam as if they know about it, and they make all sorts of statements based, you know, on one surah or another of the Quran, saying it's violent and so on. And it makes for so many myths. And, I mean, when you have, for example, these young guys here in America who go going rampant killings at universities and so on, it's a bit like, you know, suicide bombings. They end up killing themselves anyway after having killed 20 people out of a problem of identity.
Right.
And yes, right now we see that it's a lot of young Muslims doing it in Europe, but for the same problem, basically.
Yeah, well, the myths, I mean, that can't be helped. I mean, when in the 1980s, when people thought Japan was going to buy up the world, a lot of people made a handy living becoming experts on the Japanese problem. And, you know, after 9/11, there are an awful lot of experts on Islam. Soon, everybody will be learning Chinese. Who knows?
I think my role now is to say thank you. I want to say thank you to all of you for coming out, and particularly to Ian. I've been listening quite carefully, and I didn't hear a single simple-minded thought, which is unusual, I think, for public discourse these days. So thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.